Hi, I'm Lauren Gilger, co-host of the show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode. Good morning and welcome to the show here on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Lauren Gilger. Coming up, how are Arizona law enforcement trained to deal with people with disabilities, and should it be mandatory? And why the military is using video game controllers for real-life weapons? It's possible you've heard the phrase Protect Oak Flat in recent years, or maybe you've seen it in a mural or scrawled in a piece of graffiti on a Phoenix wall. Well, the battle over Oak Flat is in its final stage, and its fate lies in the hands of the U.S. Supreme Court. Oak Flat is a swath of high desert land about 70 miles east of Phoenix that's sacred to the Western Apache and other indigenous people. And it's the site of a valuable copper mine owned by a company called Resolution Copper. They're in the process of extracting 40 billion pounds of copper from the mountain in support of a green energy future. But the nonprofit Apache Stronghold has been fighting to stop them for nearly a decade. And now they're asking the Supreme Court to protect the site in the name of religious freedom. It's a case that's bringing together some strange bedfellows, and KJZZ's own Gabriel Pietrazio is here to tell us more. Hi there, Gabe.
Hi, Lauren.
Okay, so what does Oak Flat mean to the Apache people to begin with? Like, why have they fought for so long to try to protect this place?
You know, I think what's unique about Oak Flat is that, much like other communities, it's not a monolith. So some Apaches see it as sacred and others don't, from the conversations that I've had with various Apaches from San Carlos to White Mountain to Yavapai Apache Nation to the Tonto. It has different meanings, but in general, members of the San Carlos community, particularly with Apache Stronghold, which is a nonprofit and not representative of the tribal government itself, say that the Gan, which are essentially angels in their interpretation, mountain spirits reside there. And should this mining occur, that would disturb the soil and the earth where they rest, essentially. And so I was recently there a month or so ago, helping build a sweat lodge with Wenzler Nosey Sr., who is in charge, who leads the nonprofit. And so got to personally see firsthand the significance of it. They do sweats with coming of age ceremonies there and things of that sort. And I was invited to participate in helping with that process.
Wow. Yeah. So right now, though, Resolution Copper is already underway, right? They're already getting the area ready for mining in the future. You've been in that mine, in fact.
Yeah, recently I took a trip down. It was the deepest mine shaft in North America. It's about 6,844 feet to the surface.
Wow.
They're currently not extracting the ore because they actually haven't reached it yet. And I recently spoke with Vicky Pesey, who's the project manager for Resolution Copper, and she described it as building a city over a decade. So once this moves forward, if Resolution Copper is allowed to continue without any Supreme Court objections, then it would be about a decade or so to build an underground city, effectively laying concrete to reach this copper ore body that's about a mile or so away from that shaft that they had sunk.
Okay, so way under there and a whole lot of copper, as we said. So let's talk more about this case from Apache Stronghold. It was rejected by the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals in the spring, and now they're asking the U.S. Supreme Court to reconsider. Tell us about their argument.
Yeah, essentially the argument is, can tribal faiths essentially be allowed to practice on land? So essentially, is land, can land be at the center of faith and religion? That's what they're arguing for, that Oak Flat is a site of sacred significance and therefore it shouldn't be disturbed or destroyed. Otherwise, that would irreversibly harm their religion and the way that they practice their faith. Part of the petition process was them taking a prayer journey across the United States, meeting with tribal communities, but other religious groups, to build a broad coalition of support that culminated in actually filing their cert in person at the Supreme Court in September or so.
Right. Okay, so let's talk about that broad coalition, because this is where this gets really interesting. It might have seemed like a long shot, right, for them to go to the U.S. Supreme Court and say, please reconsider this decision, religious freedom grounds, right? But there are reasons, it seems, that it might not be as much of a long shot, and it has to do with that question of religious freedom and that coalition that they've built. What does it look like?
There's a broad swath of people. Some you can identify politically as left and right.
Mm-hmm.
There are some people who are environmental activists and advocates who are on the left side of the social justice issue of this is an equity problem that San Carlos and the Apache Stronghold community should have access to Oak Flat and that shouldn't be disturbed. And then you have certain entities like Utah Republican Senator Mike Lee and the Young Americas Foundation who are behind this filing supporting amicus briefs with Apache Stronghold and the Beckett Fund, who's their legal representation, is a D.C. public interest religious freedom law firm, who's basically arguing that this is a First Amendment case in some respects about the right to faith and to practice your religion freely. Superior Mayor Mila Besich basically described it as strange bedfellows recently to me. This is what she also had to say about that.
We believe that Beckett Fund is doing this in a way to win a religious freedoms case that then could upend everything that maybe we've worked for, whether it be gay marriage, interracial marriage, further, you know, abortion restrictions. That's what keeps me up at night as Mayor of Superior, is hoping that this does not upend our democracy and our true freedoms of religion.
And Gabe, the list of religious and pro-religious freedom groups, right, who are supporting Apache Stronghold at this point is pretty long. Tell us who else is backing them kind of from the right.
For sure. You know, the Knights of Columbus and the Christian Legal Society, the Religious Freedom Institute and the Sikh Coalition, as well as other entities like the Presbyterian Church of the United States, the Mennonite Church of the United States, are also signed on to, you know, their support for this case to be heard. And Beckett Fund has a track record of bringing high-profile cases to the Supreme Court on the religious freedom argument. This kind of complicates the crystal ball seeing into the future of what is to come as early as Friday now. This case has been punted a few times already. Mm-hmm.
Do you think there's a good chance here that they could convince the Supreme Court, as it stands now, which is a relatively conservative Supreme Court, to take it up?
I think there's a stronger chance for this case to be taken on. It's a religious freedoms issue. I think what's interesting is this narrative that we've heard from people like the mayor of Superior that talk about land as land like the cake issue with the Supreme Court.
Right, the case about a cake maker who didn't want to make a cake for a gay wedding, right?
That's right. Yeah, similar kind of logic, but around land and whether or not someone could essentially have access to land because it's sacred to them. Mm-hmm. So it is interesting, and it's comparable to what the court has looked at before. So it wouldn't be too surprising if the Supreme Court would take this on. I think it's far more likely than we would have been talking about compared to other cases.
Yeah. So if that happens, what does that mean for Oak Flat and for the copper mining operation that's already underway there?
Under the current conditions at this point in time, essentially all that needs to be issued is the environmental impact study, which was originally issued under Trump in his first term, but then was withdrawn under the Biden administration. It's currently – there's a record for it, meaning that that would approve the project. It could be signed at any time. It's assumed that Trump – that he would approve this. If the Supreme Court takes on the case, that complicates the project moving forward. But if it's denied, the chances of the project moving forward increase tremendously based on that, that there aren't as many legal avenues or opportunities for the Apache Stronghold or the San Carlos Apache Tribe to challenge this case in the court.
So kind of a last stand for Apache Stronghold here.
It seems to be.
Yeah. All right. We will watch and see what happens coming on Friday. Gabriel Pietrarazzo covers Indigenous affairs for us here at KJZZ. Gabe, thanks so much.
Thank you.
The Phoenix Police Department has been in the spotlight for months since the Department of Justice released a scathing report into its practices. Federal investigators found the Phoenix PD use excessive force and violate people's civil rights. Then body cam video was released showing officers beating and tasing a deaf black man with cerebral palsy named Tyrone McAlpin. The case is now raising questions about how officers deal with people with disabilities. McAlpin's attorney said he couldn't hear officers when they told him to stop as they pulled into the parking lot where he was walking. Yesterday on the show, we heard from John Myers, director of the Arizona Developmental Disabilities Planning Council, who made the argument that law enforcement in our state are not getting enough training on how to deal with people with disabilities, which can often be invisible. After the McAlpin case came to light, Governor Katie Hobbs called on the Arizona Peace Officer Standards and Training Board, or AZ Post, to issue reminders to all law enforcement in the state that there is a training available on this front. The result of a collaboration between AZ Post and the Arizona Commission for the Deaf and the Hard of Hearing. Our next guest did the governor's bidding, but told me AZ Post doesn't track how many officers took it, and he does not think it should be mandatory. Matt Giordano is executive director of AZ Post, and I spoke with him more about the training that does exist and why they created it.
It really all started with a conversation I had with Jennifer Longden. She's a former state representative.
Yes.
We had worked quite closely together during my time with the Phoenix Police Department when I was a commander of the Community Relations Bureau. I actually built out the first ever cross disabilities police chief advisory board, and Jennifer was our chairperson. So Jennifer reached out to me because she had been contacted by the Arizona Commission for the Deaf and Hard of Hearing, asking about potentially pushing legislation to create mandatory training in that area for law enforcement. So naturally, Jennifer contacted me. And I'm a huge proponent of ensuring that officers have effective communication skills. So I was on board with training. I just wanted to stay away from making it mandatory. I thought we could accomplish what we all wanted to accomplish if we worked together, created really good training, and then I turned around and pushed it out to the 158 agencies and roughly 15,000 peace officers in the state of Arizona. And it was, in my opinion, incredibly successful.
As you mentioned, you wanted to make sure this was not mandatory at the time. I want to ask you about that because there have been efforts by others in this community, the Arizona Developmental Disabilities Planning Council in particular, in the past to make this mandatory and something that officers have to take on an annual basis. That's been rejected in the past by folks at the legislature. What's your concern about making it mandatory? Why not?
Well, it's just talking with my peers around the country in other states that do legislate specific training topics. It becomes very cumbersome. It becomes cumbersome for us to track, you know, almost 15,000 peace officers and what they've accomplished throughout the year, as well as we really made a shift years ago to push back to the individual agencies for their chief and sheriff to decide what is in the best interest of the communities they serve. Training hours are limited. You know, for an officer to take training, he or she has to be pulled off the street. And that's why in-person training is very hard to coordinate. And again, when you look at different agencies around the state, they have different needs. They have different abilities. You know, take a Phoenix. It's not a problem for them to run what they call an annual module and bring 50 officers down every Friday to get training. And I know the Arizona Commission did that for Phoenix back in 2015 or 2016, mm-hmm. and it worked really well. Now translate that to a different smaller agency where they might only have five or six officers. How do you take them off the road and how do you get a trainer to come up and teach them? So in my opinion, it was much easier for us to create a digital training platform that we could push out that an officer can actually sit in their patrol car anywhere in the state as long as they have internet connectivity and take part in the training. I felt like that was a better use of everyone's time and it was more efficient.
What about training for officers when it comes to people with other kinds of disabilities? I know there's been a lot of increased awareness around folks, especially with developmental disabilities, disabilities that are, you know, invisible, right? But could very well change the way someone responds to law enforcement. Is that included anywhere in any of the mandatory or optional trainings that you have?
That is all included in our basic academy curriculum. So in addition to what we've been talking about now is advanced officer training, we also set the curriculum for the 17 statewide regional academies.
Right.
Every new officer must go through. So we have an interpersonal communication block that's 12 hours long, and it covers all of the things you just mentioned.
Okay. Do you think that there is a sense among officers, because I've heard this from some critics in light of recent events, that they're not well enough trained to deal with folks with various disabilities and that they would like to be more well prepared?
You know, I've heard that too, and I've heard it the other way as well. I've never come across a chief or sheriff that says their people are overtrained. So I think officers are always looking to obtain more training. And I think it all comes down to communication. I truly believe that effective communication is the foundation of good police work. And I really think that it just comes down to that, and learning how to communicate with all members of our community will make you successful as a police officer.
Let me ask you, Matt, in light of recent events, there's been a lot of focus on law enforcement right now, how they interact with people with disabilities. Research will show that people with disabilities are more likely to have negative interactions with law enforcement because of some of these issues we brought up. And disability advocates are sort of saying, you know, there's not enough training for officers in Arizona on this front right now. Do you think there's enough? Would you like to see more? Would you be willing to work on continuing training for officers on this front?
No, absolutely. And that's why we have the training that we developed years ago still on our public facing website. And we still make it available to training coordinators around the state. It's because, again, we're always looking to create the best possible peace officers for the entire state that we serve.
So it sounds like, though, you think, Matt, that the training that's out there right now and that you've kind of reissued to officers recently is enough if they know it's there. It does not need to be mandatory. Tell us a little bit more about what's in there, and if they listen to it, if they go through it, what they will learn.
You know, if they go through the training, what they'll understand is that the success of police work really boils down to effective communication. You know, what we're trying to teach officers is to look for cues. And I'll go back to our basic academy curriculum. I just reviewed a scenario the other day where it's the recruit responds to a call for service reference, a suspicious person in the parking lot appears to maybe be looking into vehicles. So when the officer arrives, the actor is wearing, unbeknownst to the recruit, is wearing earbuds. And they intentionally, as part of the scenario, or not to look at the officer, not to engage the officer, look away and act as though they're not hearing the officer. And what we're trying to teach the officers in that scenario is to look at the cues and not to immediately believe that the person is being noncompliant. We really want them to understand is, what are you looking at? What is the person doing? What are their behaviors? And again, look for different ways to address them. It's the same. It goes back to crisis intervention techniques and teaching officers when they respond to calls for service with members of the community. If you see someone that looks agitated, walking around, pacing, fists clenched, maybe talking to themselves, that's not an automatic sign of noncompliance. You know, start assessing it, looking at it, trying to understand, try to engage them, lower your voice. Don't be threatening. Don't invade their space and give them time. Because again, as peace officers, time is almost always on our side. And if we just slow things down, communicate effectively, and try to resolve the situation, it can oftentimes be done without any use of force being necessary, and where it's not even required. So again, we really think the training out there is viable. We think it's appropriate. We think it's been well received. And in my opinion, we just got to get back to effective communication to ensure that we can connect with our diverse community. We serve a diverse community. And oftentimes when you respond to a call for service, you don't know that. But we're trying to teach these young men and women entering this career and throughout their career on how to look at things holistically, how to look from the outside in and not just assume that someone is noncompliant based on their behaviors. Now, we do deal with people that are noncompliant, and we've taught officers how to deal with that.
Yeah.
But again, oftentimes it's just effective communication to figure out what is going on with that person you're interacting with.
All right, we'll leave it there. Matt Giordano, Executive Director of the Arizona Peace Officer Standards and Training Board, joining us to talk about this. Matt, thank you for coming on. I appreciate you taking the time.
Thank you for having me.
Good morning. It is the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger. Coming up, a new documentary details the radioactive history of Route 66.
The physical hazards of mining were explained to miners, but the long-term consequences of exposure to radiation were not explained at all.
We'll hear from the film's director about the lasting impact of atomic testing. But first, immigration has been a major issue in Arizona and across the country for decades. And undocumented young people have often been a driving force in that conversation. Our next guest looks at how this population has developed and evolved in its activism over the years. Rafael Martinez is an assistant professor of Southwest Borderlands at ASU and author of the new book, Illegalized: Undocumented Youth Movements in the United States. He spoke with my co-host, Mark Brody, and they started with how Rafael identifies himself as an undocu scholar.
Yeah, so it's really the combination of my two identities. One, growing up undocumented in the United States, so lived experience of that perspective. And then also, you know, going through graduate school and now being a professor and educator is really coming to terms with the identity as a scholar and really bringing the work that I do at the service of community and centering that first.
How do you find that your lived experience, your own childhood, impacts what you do now?
Yeah, well, I'll point to the title of the book again, Illegalized, because I wanted to talk about illegality as a framework, not just in the macro level, the big picture items that we often think about, which is the border, the borderlands, detention, deportation. But I also wanted to talk about the micro level things, everyday actions. So growing up, I'll give you a quick example. I didn't get my driver's license in California when all my youth friends were getting their driver's license because we couldn't get a driver's license at that time. And so that impacted my realities of where I went to school, how I moved around, how I made friends and everything. So I want to talk about illegality and the way in which it impacts undocumented immigrants on an everyday basis.
When did you find that undocumented people, especially younger people, really started to recognize that they could have a social impact, a political impact?
Yes. Well, first, the DREAM Act got introduced in early 2001, and it went on three times to be introduced, never passing. It would have given a pathway to citizenship for undocumented youth. But that introduced undocumented youth to the public sphere. It grew in cultural capital and visibility for undocumented youth. And then undocumented youth realized that they could work in the political system, but then they also needed to push the system to do more, because when the failure didn't happen with the DREAM Act, they realized that things weren't going to come about until they actually put additional pressure, and that led to different forms of organizing.
What kinds of models, if any, did this population of people look to for, okay, here's what we want to do, and we know that we have the capital to make this happen, but how are we actually going to do it? Like, were there other examples of groups of people who tried to do this sort of thing that undocumented youth look to?
Yes, I'll point to the fact that most of these activists that I write about were trained by folks and leaders in the civil rights movement. Mm. And so, of course, if you remember in the 60s, 70s, there was a lot of civil disobedience in the country. But then they also had to push politicians to pass measures that would actually make significant change. And so undocumented youth took a page from that history book and started to say, we need to take our activism to sites and places like detention centers where undocumented communities are being criminalized, and we need to change the narrative.
How would you say that these efforts have evolved since, you know, the early 2000s?
Yeah, it's changed into the fact that, you know, I think we went to the period where we were building mass movements and national movements. And I think that undocumented youth that I write about wanted to change those discourse to found or establish organizations more at the local and state level, because they realized that federal policy was still happening, but very minimally. And where actually policy was happening was at the state level and local levels. Hmm. Enforcement of immigration were happening at those levels. And so the national still kept happening, but they needed to form organizations that weren't going to be national and require this massive funding and support to run. But if those national organizations came together, it could be this conglomerate of that was flexible and withstanding to be able to do small-scale actions that disrupt immigration systems.
Let me ask you about what you found about Arizona, because around, you know, like 2010 era, of course, SB 1070 was signed into law. Former Maricopa County Sheriff Joe Arpaio was in office. And we hear about how a lot of sort of the political leaders of today who are Latino were sort of formed during that period of SB 1070 and Joe Arpaio. What did you find in terms of how people were trying to organize specifically in Arizona around those issues?
Yes. Well, you know, I look at two particular actions. One of them that happened in 2010 of undocumented youth that conducted a sit-in in the late John McCain's office in Tucson. And what that did is, again, it gave youth in the state of Arizona a visual that civil disobedience was possible, because the folks who conducted that sit-in would be arrested but wouldn't be detained and deported. And so that cultural capital offered possibilities to undocumented youth to realize, hey, we could use our cultural capital and exchange that to be able to affect change in the state. And I think that built a critical consciousness in youth in the state to then go on and build their own organizations and be able to be the foundation and base that we see in Arizona now, who is pushing anti-immigrant rhetoric and legislation away after SB 1070 happened. So I think that it was successful in breeding this new ideas for undocumented youth in the state and allies alike.
Are you finding that people who are coming up now as activists, are they using the same kind of methods? Because obviously those people were either very, very young or maybe not even born when originally the DREAM Act was introduced in the very early 2000s. Like, are you seeing a continued evolution here?
I would say so, because since 2017, DACA has been challenged in the mm-hmm. Supreme Court. And so we have a whole generation that hasn't benefited or been able to apply for deferred action for childhood arrivals or DACA. And so that whole generation is growing very disappointed, disillusioned that nothing has been done for them or their families. And I think they're looking for ways of organizing and continuing civil disobedience, putting pressure on the political system. I'm hoping that this book offers guidelines. And again, not that they're doing exactly what's in the book, but that offers ideas and creativity on how they could put pressure in the political system.
How do the people who are involved in this activism define success? I mean, you mentioned the DREAM Act, which still, you know, 20-something years later is still for just a dream.
Yeah, the DREAM Act is still a dream, and it's still being talked about and discussed. But in 2012, we did get a DACA. So that was directly a result of organizing. And I think, again, the wins maybe haven't happened at the federal level, but at the state level, we are definitely seeing more states become and pass pro-immigrant legislation, such as driver's licenses, in-state tuition, state aid, and many other resources that can support their undocumented communities.
Where do you see this movement going in the near term?
Yes, I think, unfortunately, as we continue to not have immigration relief, unfortunately, the movement has to continue to grow and evolve and change. And so I think that's not going to stop. But I do think that undocumented youth have realized that we continue to put pressure on the political system, not just for one party or two parties, but multiple politicians, that we need to advocate for immigration reform.
All right. That is Rafael Martinez, an assistant professor of Southwest Borderlands at ASU, author of the book Illegalized Undocumented Youth Movements in the United States. Rafael, thanks so much for the conversation. I appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
Good morning. It is the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger. Military weapons systems continue to get more advanced and sophisticated, but some components of them might be recognizable to anyone who's shopped at an electronics store recently. Jared Keller is managing editor of content at military.com and a contributor to Wired magazine. He says it's difficult to overstate how familiar the average American is with a video game controller, and that the military is trying to use that to its advantage. That means some weapons include controllers that are very similar to those used for gaming systems like PlayStation or Xbox. Keller has written about this and spoke with my co-host Mark Brody more about it. And they started with just how similar some of these controllers that the military is using are to what gamers would recognize from playing Call of Duty or other games.
At first glance, these controllers appear extremely similar to the standard Xbox or PlayStation controller. They have the same elongated hand grips for extra control. They have the same dual joysticks on either side, and they have the same top-level trigger buttons as well. So they appear extremely similar to those control systems that come with a standard video game console.
It sounds like there might be a but, though. Like, I assume they're not just going to Best Buy and, like, buying a PlayStation and attaching that to a drone or some other kind of weapon system.
In some cases, that's actually been exactly what they've done.
Really?
Is used control off-the-shelf systems, like the Xbox controller, to control, for example, explosive ordnance disposal robots. The tracked robots that soldiers will often send into dangerous zones to deal with improvised explosive devices or other unexploded munitions. So there are instances where militaries have used commercial off-the-shelf controllers, literally identical to those that you would use on an Xbox. But yes, you're absolutely right. The freedom of movement control unit, which is specially adopted for military systems, does have some unique systems attached to it. For example, some of the variants of the FMC you control include like a safety switch, so that you don't accidentally fire off a round or a munition when you don't intend to.
So I imagine that part of the reason for this is that some number of folks in the military are just used to playing video games on Xbox or PlayStation, so they're kind of familiar with how the controller works. But I'm wondering if there are other reasons that the military is citing for why they're using these.
One of the primary reasons is familiarity. Right, the video game industry has spent decades training the entire subset of young Americans to operate these controllers. This means that when they eventually turn 18 and are eligible to join the armed forces, they're already familiar with a new system. So that's less time spent training people up on a unique, novel control system and more time spent focusing on other things like tactical training. But the other reason is that the video game system has proven it's somewhat easier to use compared to the standard issue joystick or a panel of buttons or toggles. There's been studies that have indicated that joysticks and tactile controllers provide a much better sensory experience than a touchscreen, for example, and therefore more precision and control over a system than a touchscreen may offer.
Are touchscreens sort of the most recent previous technology that the military had been using for some of these systems?
It really depends what system you're talking about. The most recent incident where a tactile system was proven more effective than a touchscreen system was during the 2017 collision between the Arleigh Burke-class Navy destroyer, the USS John McCain, and an oil tanker off the coast of Singapore. A National Transportation Safety Board report on the accident indicated that sailors weren't totally familiar with the touchscreens that were used for helm control on the bridge. And had the control system been more tactile instead, a joystick or a wheel or a series of switches, and that would have proven potentially more useful to sailors reacting in a high-stress situation like that collision.
Hmm. So for how long have various branches of the military been using these kinds of, sort of video game-like or actual video game controllers?
Upwards of 20 years.
Wow.
That they've been experimenting with this. But the FMCU is interesting because it's been seen as proliferating more recently across a variety of weapons platforms.
Is this the kind of thing that the military uses in its recruiting to try to get people to join in a sense of saying, hey, look, we want you to join. And look, you're already going to walk in knowing kind of how to use some of the stuff that you would be using.
There's certainly a benefit to say to a prospective recruit that, hey, if you can do Call of Duty, you can do this. Although that's not necessarily the case, as I'm sure most service members would argue. But to a certain extent, yeah, there is an appeal by saying, hey, this is just like a video game, except it has real world consequences. To make the ease and familiarity that a prospective service member may find fitting into the service is definitely lowers the barrier for entry for them in the long term.
I also wonder if this maybe says something about the amount of warlike or, shoot 'em up type games that exist that, it's not, I would imagine there's a difference between playing, NBA 2K on one of these controllers and operating, a drone or something. Like I would think that having used these controllers in a combat, conflict, warlike setting is maybe even more helpful than playing, Legend of Zelda, for example.
That's certainly true. I mean, there's the context of it, of course. But it also helps that the U.S. military has used video games for explicitly for recruiting for years. I mean, the Army, Navy, Marine Corps, Air Force and Space Force all have esports teams that engage in video game tournaments on a pretty regular basis, usually around Call of Duty and other military-themed games. So the DoD is constantly trying to bridge that gap between gamers and potential recruits.
What do folks who really pay attention to this kind of thing say the future is going to be? Like, what are you, what are other folks looking for next?
Well, it's funny. There's a quote from The Simpsons from years ago where the commandant in a military academy is giving a graduation speech. And he says something to the effect of, the next war will be fought on top in space or on top of a very tall mountain. But what he really says is that the next wars will be fought by robots fighting other robots, and it will be your job to service those robots. And that's not actually too far off. With the proliferation of drones, commercial, off-the-shelf, small, fast, easily weaponizable drones, we're seeing those take over the battle space. Drones are the future, and making those drones as easy and intuitive to control as possible is going to be the future as well.
Jared Keller is managing editor of content at military.com and a contributor to Wired magazine. Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger. Route 66 is known for its history. It's a cultural touchstone that represents the expansion to the west, the Mother Road, vintage cars and diners and Americana trinket shops. But our next guest is the director of a new short film that documents another more troubling history of Route 66. It's Atomic History. In it, Katrina Parks profiles some of the women from the Redwater Pond community on the Navajo Nation, 15 miles north of Route 66, including Edith Hood.
My grandfather used to say, or my grandma, if you want to take something from Mother Nature, you say a prayer, put out your pollen, but you only take what you need. And then those kind of things started thinking about that with the mining industry. I said, they didn't take just what they need, they took the whole thing and left a mess that they didn't clean up.
Community organizers there have been working to get uranium tailings removed from their land for decades. But theirs is just one of the stories Parks unearthed as part of this project. She told me it all started for her with her first documentary series on Route 66 about women on the Mother Road.
The film series was finished, so I was actually doing presentations, and someone in the audience asked if I had ever considered the effect of atomic testing on women's lives, and specifically if I knew about the downwinders and how many communities along Route 66 were impacted. And, you know, I drew a blank, and luckily Arizona state historian Marshall Trimble was there in the audience, and he certainly counts family members among the downwinders. And he explained that that's the name, you know, used to refer to people who experienced radiation as a result of the atomic testing at the Nevada test site, which didn't end until 1962, and that there are, in fact, many communities along Route 66, like Kingman, Seligman, Winslow, Gallup, where there are clusters of downwinders. Uh-huh. So that was intriguing to me. And then when I started to do more research, I realized that the Route 66 region has really faced a triple impact. Not only are the communities impacted by atomic testing, but also, I would say, by the development of nuclear industries and specifically uranium mining.
Wow. Okay. So zoom in for us on Redwater Pond and the people that you profile there, because they've been working for decades, it sounds like, to get uranium tailings removed from their land and have faced a lot of challenges in doing that. Remind us of the history here. You said this goes back quite a long time.
Yes. Yeah, so uranium mining really was propelled by the Cold War. After World War II, the United States really wanted to find a domestic source of uranium, and the Colorado Plateau region happens to be very rich in it. So under this need to develop more weapons, this huge rush to exploit uranium took place, and there wasn't much thought given to the health and safety of the workers. And that's something that when you talk to people at the Redwater Pond community really becomes clear. Edith Hood, one of the women that I interviewed in what is now a short film, but will hopefully become a longer project.
Yeah.
She actually worked in a mine, and she talks about how the physical hazards of mining were explained to miners, but the long-term consequences of exposure to radiation were not explained at all. And so it's something that she, along with many others, have had to deal with over the decades.
What are the health implications for these communities? Because these impacts, as you said, which began so long ago, are still being felt today.
Yeah, I mean, the most obvious health impact are clusters of cancer. But I think it's also, you know, the impact on traditional lifestyles, you know, particularly when you're talking to people from the Redwater Pond community, that is something that becomes very clear because they can no longer have, for example, livestock in the way that they had for centuries on that land.
Right.
I was very lucky to collaborate with three amazing women from the Redwater Pond Community Association who are leading this effort to remove this uranium tailings pile from their homeland.
Right.
But I also interviewed, for example, a uranium miner, a woman whose father was involved in testing at the Nevada test site, and a nuclear scientist. So my interest is in kind of uncovering these hidden stories of the nuclear legacy and trying to give it a human face, but from many different voices and experiences.
Yeah, yeah. So I want to know more about the women from the Redwater Pond community who you mentioned there. I mean, why has it been so difficult for them and taken so long to get rid of these tailings?
Well, as I understand it, the issue now is that the surrounding communities don't want the tailings pile moved through their communities. So the uranium tailings pile, what it contains is not uranium. It's something, you know, much less radioactive. And the damage to the community has taken place because of their exposure over a long-term exposure to these tailings. But the communities around them are concerned about 20,000, whatever number of truckloads it is, of this material going through on its way to a landfill.
Right. You mentioned Edith Hood and the fact that she used to work in the mine, which was true for so many people in this part of the state, particularly people on Navajo land. This was also a source of jobs, right?
Yes, it certainly was. And I interviewed a miner who worked at the Haystack mine, and he talked about, you know, he was excited to have the job. It was a way that he could build a better future for his family. He grew up facing a lot of discrimination in Winslow, and he really worked his way up. And he paid a very high price for that work. So I guess it's kind of humbling. They're humbling stories to listen to because you can feel, you understand the choices people made and why they made them. It was, you know, a good job, and there seemed to be a path upward mobility within the industry.
Right, right. So complicated, so human. Let me ask you, Katrina, just what struck you most in the making of this project so far? I mean, like, this is obviously complicated. There are so many personal stories involved. What do you think about when you think about this most?
Well, I think about how history sadly is repeating itself because, you know, we have, you know, in Arizona in particular, there's the reopening of the Pinon Plain mine, which has caused a lot of controversy because of the impact on indigenous lands and people again.
But this is also going on today in a different way, right? Because there is pressure on lawmakers in Washington to reauthorize and expand the Radiation Exposure Compensation Act before the end of the year, which is coming up rapidly here. What kind of difference would that make for the downwinders that you profile here?
It would make a big difference. And I, of course, hope that Congress will do that.
All right, we'll have to leave it there. That is Katrina Parks, the director of the documentary film The Atomic Legacy on Route 66, joining us. Katrina, thank you for coming on. Thank you for talking about this. I appreciate it.
Thanks so much.
Thanks for listening to the show on this Wednesday, and be sure to join us tomorrow morning with much more as always. And don't forget to follow us on Instagram. We are at KJZZ The Show. If you heard a song you liked, by the way, on today's show, including this one, of course, you can follow us on Spotify. Just search KJZZ's The Show on the app and you will find our monthly playlist. For Mark Brody, I'm Lauren Gilger. Thanks for joining us. That's it for this episode of the show's podcast. To find out more about the stories from today or other episodes, you can visit theshow.kjzz.org. And you can subscribe to KJZZ's The Show on your favorite podcasting site. I'm Lauren Gilger for Mark Brody. Thanks for listening today.